Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I think every sensible American, regardless of political persuasion, and regardless of whether they have school-age kids or not, is concerned about the long-term effects of the COVID-driven impacts on education, from preschool all the way really through university education. And new national research shows that parents in particular are afraid that students who lost time in school during the pandemic shutdowns could experience lasting effects on their learning and career opportunities. And I think that's pretty obvious to all of us, although what those effects might be aren't clear. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today. A Harris poll conducted in summer 2021 explored the long-term personal, professional, mental, and financial ramifications for students impacted by the school shutdowns. So that's our topic today. And I think the impacts are broad and deep and are just beginning to be widely recognized. My guest today is a reporter for The Center Square, which is a news network that covers state and local level news nationwide. His name is Casey Harper. Welcome, Casey.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on with us. I want to say up front that neither of us is an expert on this, and it might be that it's so new that there are no experts on it. In fact, I looked around and I could see, you know, there are a couple of scholarly papers on different aspects of it and different countries even. But really, it's the kind of thing that a lot of people are thinking about, but it has not become a big topic yet where there are pundits and that kind of thing talking about it. And so that's why we're doing it. But I did see that you wrote an article, Casey, that I saw online recently that described the results of this survey that I just mentioned. So why don't we start off by asking you to tell us what was found in that Harris poll?
Absolutely. You're entirely correct that this is something that's very much on people's minds. And the poll that I reported on at thecentersquare.com went into this in detail. And what it found was that the vast majority, 84%, think that there's going to be, and they use the language of, quote unquote, a lost generation of students. So that there'll be a problem for employers in the U.S. This poll in particular took the angle of how is this going to impact the workforce? It is kind of an economic leaning, but there's a lot of different ways to explore this. And it also found that 81% of adults think that these school disruptions, the closures, even masking, you know, there's been studies about how masks covering children's faces might inhibit their ability to interpret social cues. But 81% of adults think that all these school issues are going to create big challenges for young people in their future, particularly in their job performance. And they're calling it a lost generation.
Okay. You know, so, I mean, we're going to get into different aspects of those things later in the show. But, I mean, let's just kind of plunge in with the big thing with remote learning, you know, all the Zoom classes and I guess other platforms too, but it was all new to most people. I mean, in the beginning, everybody had to learn how to use it, and from teachers to students. And a big problem with it was low participation rates. A teacher friend of mine, for example, told me that, I guess this was back probably in spring of 2020, that typically in a class of about 30 students that were supposed to show up on Zoom, maybe there'd be five or six, a tiny percentage really. And so what do you do about that? And to some extent, there were problems in connectivity. Suddenly students who didn't have a laptop at home or didn't have good internet access couldn't do it. And, you know, it was just chaotic, just a very tricky thing to have to deal with. So you can say we know how many students don't turn their cameras on. And, you know, it's difficult to teach blank screens. But, you know, what else would you like to say about that particular topic?
Oh, man, there's so much. And it's interesting. I live in the D.C. area. I cover, you know, national politics, as you alluded to. And I've spent some time mentoring a couple of young boys who live in D.C. And I've asked them about this issue a few times. And it's been very interesting, some of the things they told me. For example, you know, one of them who is 12 years old, he watches his classes in bed. You know, he puts his head on the pillow. He's under the covers. He has the computer right there. And I'm just thinking back to when I was 12 years old. The idea that I would actually be paying attention to what was happening, even if I did come to class, even if I was in that percentage, because I probably would have been, my parents were the type where I would have been in every class. It's just how I was raised. But I find it hard to believe that I would have actually been paying attention. I mean, even as an adult in the professional world, we have these Zoom meetings, staff meetings, and you can just tell people's eyes are glazed over a little bit. It's hard to be engaged, even as an adult. And so I think it's just to imagine that these kids, and especially boys, I mean, we can talk about this a little bit, but a lot of studies show that boys have a lot more trouble sitting still than girls do. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, they're prescribed ADHD medicine much more because of that. The idea that a boy is going to sit alone in his room for 7 or 8 hours a day and stare at a computer, anyone who's had boys or spent a lot of time around boys just probably would laugh at that idea. There's the idea of, even if they are there, are they really paying attention, is concerning. And then the thing I want to make sure we hit on a little bit here is that, you know, poorer families are hit even harder by this for some of the reasons you outlined. I mean, you can imagine the scenario where this 12-year-old boy is. If he has a single parent and, like, say, is a single mom and she has to work. So he's at home alone all day on a computer. And, you know, we're just doing the honor system for this 12-year-old boy who has no parents at home. It's sad and it's kind of laughable at the same time. I mean, and then the same is true with the connectivity issues. Who's more likely to have solid internet, high quality internet connections? If someone's computer breaks, who's more likely to go to the store that day and buy a new computer? You know, if a kid loses his charger, who's more likely to have a parent at home who can run to the store and get him another charger so they can make their afternoon class? These kind of things add up. And especially when you look at them on the aggregate, poor families, and there's some research about how poor students are being hit harder by this, but it just takes a little bit of common sense and thinking through it to know that some kids are being hurt even more than others.
Yeah. I mean, like you just summarized very well, it just basically exaggerates the disparities socioeconomically among families and kids. And that's not something we need at this time in history at all, you know? So I mean, what are some things that teachers can do to sort of reduce those disparities and try to ameliorate that situation a little bit and improve it?
Yeah. I mean, for teachers listening, I mean, in some sense, they know better than I do, but Zoom does have features to, you know, there's chat boxes, there's things that you can do. There's ways to interact with clicking. And I'm sure that many teachers are taking advantage of this. I'm not going to tell teachers how to run their classes, but I can imagine that just seeing the teachers' faces means a lot to kids. You know, students really pull a lot of energy from an excited, vibrant teacher. And so if there's teachers on there who don't have their cameras turned on, I think, man, I don't think those kids have too much of a chance of really paying attention and being engaged. Obviously, interactive is going to be super important for kids. You don't want, if you have a 45-minute monologue lecture with no camera on, I don't think I could pay attention to that. So let alone a 12-year-old. You know, those are some things that come to mind, but it's challenging. You know, teachers are doing their best in this pandemic, but it's challenging regardless.
So, I mean, you know, one thing that occurs to me is talking about the workforce, that the professions will really suffer. We're talking about here about a cohort of kids who ranged 2 years ago from the age of 6 to 21 or something, you know, a huge bolt of kids in the pipeline who are going to be affected by this to different levels and in different ways. And there's no way that will avoid having an effect on the professions in the future. I mean, from those professions that rely on critical, logical thinking like the law and teaching and business, to those that require in particular specific in-depth knowledge like science and engineering and technical fields, you know, where your education involves lab work and you can't go into the university and be in the lab and, you know, it's closed. So, the professor's trying to make up some little thing you can do at home, you know, which is not the same at all as dealing with a fully equipped chemistry lab, you know, that kind of thing. And so,
yeah, I mean, there is a report from the Northwest Evaluation Association that, you know, studied, you know, more than 4 million U.S. students, third grade through eighth grade, and found that in math, for example, students are falling behind objectively based on the scores, average of 5 to 10 percentile points behind students who took the test the same time last year. And math is really interesting because other studies show that if kids fall behind in math too far, they never recover. In some ways, it's intuitive, but it's confirmed by research that once you kind of miss a step in math, you never really can recover. If you don't master division, you can't do algebra. And often those kids never do get the chance to catch up. Maybe they're embarrassed to admit that they don't know very well, or maybe the teachers just don't want to take the time to catch them up because that will come at the expense of all their other students. But there's a lot of things that happen. But when you fall behind, especially in these, as you referenced, these more these subjects like math, or science, it's harder to catch up than other subjects like reading or history.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, let's kind of switch gears a little bit to talking about the socialization of students. And you talked about that in terms of wearing a mask, that you can't see the visual facial cues that people use to express what they're doing, you know. And so in general, though, these kids aren't around kids playing and doing what they do at school. They don't have recess. They're not sitting next to a bunch of other kids and dealing with each other out in the hall, walking between classes and so on. And at lunch, you know, they're not being socialized in the same way, and they're not getting that early social development that you really don't even remember getting as an adult, but it's just sort of the foundation of your personality. And
Absolutely.
That foundation is just missing, and people don't even know it's missing. So, I mean, you know, say a little bit about that if you could.
Many of your listeners will know that famous book, All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. I think it's 1989.
Yeah.
But it just, it's a funny example of how we actually do, we take for granted how important the early socialization is. I've done some reading on, you know, early childhood education and development, and there are foundational lessons and you have to learn them as a kid. And if you don't learn them by a certain age, you are not the same as everyone else. Actually, we've all met people who just couldn't get along with anyone. You know, we've all met an individual who just off, quote unquote, mm-hmm. off mm-hmm. and really socially ostracized. And many of these people, they actually skipped one of these steps and they never recovered. Because what happens is if you miss one of the life lessons of socialization at an early age, what happens is your peers begin to distance themselves from you mm-hmm. because you're behind. And then it compounds because you've been kind of ostracized. You learn even slower. And so it compounds and you become, you know, I don't want to say the word outcast, but socially you become ostracized. And so there's real importance to these things. I mean, all those, we kind of, as kids, we thought we were just goofing off or things, but there's a lot of value when you're in the fourth grade and you say that mean joke and then you see it hurt someone's feelings. You see the look on their face and you think, oh man, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. Like that's a really important moment in your development. You have to have that moment and then make the decision. I need to be nicer with my jokes. Or when you're in the fifth grade and you're trying to make everyone in the class laugh and you say a really loud, obnoxious joke and no one laughs and you just sit in that awkwardness, that's a really instructive life lesson. And, you know, I think we, you and I, we're talkers. We might be in danger of the ones who never learned the lessons about the obnoxious jokes. But you know what I mean? I mean, so these are the kind of couple of examples of socialization, why it's important. And if you don't get that stuff, it really does hurt you in the workplace. I mean, you think, I know that when you're in high school and college, they tell you that your grades are what matters and your grades do matter. But when you get in the workforce, you realize that what really matters most is being able to deal with people, to communicate, to have relationships, to work on a team, to lead a team. Sure. And some of the technical skills you can learn later, but the social skills are very important to your employment.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems like kind of a mild version of some sort of artificial autism that it could induce in people because they, oh, I forget the name of the thing on the autism spectrum, but there's a version of that where somebody just talks too loud and doesn't react to the people that they're talking to and doesn't get that they're being rubbed the wrong way by what you're doing. And, you know, the kind of thing you're just describing. And, you know, I think all this goes on against the backdrop of the slow fracturing of the American nuclear family. I mean, the divorce rate has been sky high for so long now. And, you know, drug use is much more common and financial instability is much more prevalent than it was 40, 50 years ago, I think, in general. And children, I think, just don't have the sense of security and stability that they had a generation or two ago. And, you know, I think it's probably, I don't know if it's sociologically been proved, but I think it's pretty obvious to me, as somebody who's lived through several generations and has a good memory. And, you know, so now the removal of most of the layer of socialization and stability that school always provided is a big deal, because that was something that stabilized kids and their personalities and then their social persona and their personal social beings, you know, and now that's largely been taken away for a couple of years here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a kind of a big deal. So what do you think are the possible social impacts of a large cohort of students growing into adults who lack some of these basic socialization experiences that attending school always imparted?
I mean, it's a very interesting question. In some ways, that is the question. I think I would be in the realm of speculation. I'll venture to do that a bit.
Sure.
And so for some people listening may say these guys are just speculating on all this stuff. We're not citing exact reports. But to your point earlier, Court, it takes a while for data to come out. It's going to take years for the research to really figure out what exactly has happened to this generation because of COVID. We have some early signs. So yes, we are at some level forced to speculate because of the proximity to the event that we're in. But it's important that we do at least try to talk through these things, because I think this is a really important issue. I think it's really important that you're doing this show. An example that comes to mind is some of the things we've seen in East Asian countries, where things like the one-child policy have totally changed the social dynamics of the whole country. Or,
good point. Yeah.
You know, we've seen in some of these in the East Asian countries where young people at much lower rates are having intimate relationships, right? Hmm. And so I think we'd be naive to say something like that couldn't happen here. I think that we don't really have the evidence that that will happen, but, you know, time will only tell. But there have been examples of countries in modern times that their whole social fabric is different for different reasons. Maybe it was government policy. Maybe it was just a a cultural change, but we're not immune to the idea that something like this could happen if we continue down this road. I don't think we're in level that extreme yet, but we have seen these big social shifts in recent years.
Well, I mean, you know, just at a kind of a pragmatic level, I can see that this kind of thing we're talking about, this lower level of socialization experience, could lead to people being more shy and more introverted more mistrustful or less trustful of others, and, you know, maybe less willing and able to be contributing and involved members of society, and, you know, maybe more susceptible to control by powerful people and forces and organizations, you know, are not team players. I mean, look at business and the way that corporations run, and they, you know, they rely on people to collaborate and coordinate and communicate and all those words that start with CO and cooperate you know, those kind of things can all be eroded greatly, and that would have a tremendous effect throughout the whole society. So you are listening to American Variety Radio, by the way. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Casey Harper, who's a reporter who has done a couple articles on the topic we're discussing here, which is the impact of COVID and the school shutdowns and all that on education and on the future of people in our society as a result of the kind of changes in their educational experience or the lack thereof that they're getting. So the researchers that we talked about in this Harris poll found that Americans are concerned that the loss in education will have a long-term impact on gross domestic product and mental health and affect a student's lifetime earning capacity. And you said that at the beginning, that it focused a lot on the economic aspects. But I think let's focus here on the mental health impacts if we can. Again, you and I aren't, you know, psychiatrists or anything of the sort. And as I said at the beginning, we're just talking. We're having a discussion here about things that people everywhere think about, you know. And so we're just kind of surfacing some of these things. But my gosh, there's been a tremendous rise in school shootings and in suicides of young people. So is there anything you can say, you know, on that topic?
It's a very important, troubling topic and troubling trend. And, you know, I will get into that. The preface I'll say is that what it does tell us is that school closures and some of these policies that were pitched to us as obvious and better for the health of students, that it's not quite so obvious. Maybe it is in some cases better, but it's not so simple as, you know, it's 100% an obvious good decision to always close schools, because there are side effects and there are even health side effects, health impacts of doing this. And so we have to be open to having a conversation about it. An example of that is, you know, there are 14 school shootings in just the 4 months between March and June of 2021. So that's when the school reopenings began. And then as of the end of November of 2021, there have been 28 school shootings. So that's, those are either, you know, injury or death so far in 21, with 20 of them reported since August 1st. You know, we have other mental health, and school shootings is one metric. But according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, I'm actually looking at, this is from Pew, but they did a study, a similar study on this. Suspected suicide attempts among adolescents jumped 31% in 2020. 31%. I mean, that's very high. It's a stark jump compared to the previous year. And so suicide attempts were 51% higher among girls aged 12 to 17. Wow. So that's from February to March. So, you know, we're seeing there's hard data on attempted suicides. It's apparently affecting young girls more than young boys. Let's see. I'm reading directly from Pew now. It says, on top of social isolation and family instability, the medical group said that more than 140,000 children in the U.S. lost a primary and or secondary caregiver, with youth of color disproportionately impacted. And that's a great point. Mm-hmm. That's something we haven't hit on at all, is, I mean, kids are losing their parents, you know, or grandparents.
Wow. Yeah.
So to have a generation that prematurely lost their grandparents or parents, you know, we may not have time to go into all of that, but this is just creating this kind of perfect storm where kids are isolated, they're more suicidal. And so I think that's why it's important to have this conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, the parents themselves are struggling to cope.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Even as you mentioned, you know, single parents who have to go to work, or if there are two parents, then they decide who are working, they decide which one keeps their job and which one stays home. And in many cases, employers are flexible about it, but in some cases they haven't been or can't be, because it's a job that requires you to be there, to be a waiter in a restaurant or whatever it might be.
Right.
And so when those parents get involved with their kids staying home and being online for education, you know, I know from friends and family of mine that the parents have to get involved in helping the kids deal with the online education process, particularly in the early stages of the school shutdowns and the pandemic. And So that was, you know, I mean, suddenly you're 38 years old and you're having to learn algebra again. And, you know, and it's, you know,
and you never learned it the first time.
So yeah, you know. You barely struggled by with a C when you were eighth grade or whatever it is, you know, but now you're having to do it again. So, but those are the good parents who care and are trying hard to keep their head above water while dealing with this. But to be honest, I mean, what about the children of dysfunctional parents who are maybe very poorly educated themselves and unemployed and, you know, are in different kinds of trouble, you know, drugs and alcohol or in jail or whatever it might be, and either won't or can't make the needed effort. I mean, those kids have no role model to speak of to start with, and then they're on their own in trying to deal with this. And you talked about that earlier, about the end of the social economic spectrum where kids don't have the, you know, just the high-speed internet access they need and that kind of thing, but where they don't have a support net under them for that, it's just almost impossible to expect them to try to excel. I mean, maybe, I don't know what the numbers would be, but it'd be a small percentage who would struggle through that themselves and manage to do what they need to do. It's just almost too much to ask, as you said, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and there's other issues like free school lunches that we haven't even hit on. You know, a lot of kids don't have a lunch, and so they actually are fed by the school. And then you gave the example of parents having jobs that require them to be there. You know, I didn't cover this at length. I don't have hard data to back this up, but I think you can imagine that who is more likely to have a job that requires you actually be in the location? Is it going to be white collar or service sector? And I think it's going to be the kid who, I mean, for example, I'm a reporter. I work, you know, remotely almost entirely. My wife has a similar job. You know, if we had to educate a kid, we could probably keep both of our jobs or be, you know, be there with the kid while they were doing online school. We could both be present, sit around the kitchen table together and all just work on our laptops and be there. But a kid further down the socioeconomic scale, his mom has to be at the department store, right? And she can't do that on Zoom. If you work in any kind of food industry, you have to be there. If you work in retail, you have to be there. If you drive a taxi or an Uber, you have to be there.
Yeah, you're a carpenter or a plumber or an electrician.
Yeah, you know, you cannot fix somebody's electricity.
You can't tell them, go watch a YouTube video. Call me later.
But the people who do consulting, the people who do IT, the people who work on business, at least in part, maybe they have to go in a couple of days a week, but they're going to be much more likely to be able to work remotely, which is going to be to the benefit of their kids. And it seems like that's emerging as a theme of our conversation, that it disproportionately impacts. So the fewer resources you have, the fewer resources you have.
Just widens that disparity, that gap. So you said earlier there's no recovering. I think the 2 years that have been partly or largely lost so far, especially in some subjects, in some areas of education. And, you know, but you can't hold a generation back for 2 years. So even if the system returns to normal, let's say whatever normal will be in a year or so, the education system will still stumble forward with this very large, poorly educated cohort of students having to perform remedial education on the fly if they can. So, you know, did the survey say anything about that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. They use the language of lost generation in the survey. And I think, you know, one interesting question could be for us is, do we think that's hyperbolic? I think right now, I think it's probably premature to say. You know, I'll just quote the survey spokesman first. But he says, this disruptions to education will mean a whole generation or more is falling further behind. Getting back to pre-pandemic status quo won't be enough. All Americans are in general agreement. We're witnessing the creation of a lost generation. That's what they said. That's the conclusion they came to. My take, and I'd be curious to hear what you say, Court. This is a generation that's facing extreme and unusual challenges, but it's probably too early to say they're a lost generation. They might be, but I don't think we can know that yet. We can't know that until they graduate high school and enter the workforce, and we don't want to write them off. And I know that's not your heart at all. We're trying to solve this problem. We're trying to talk about it, but I think it's premature to call them a lost generation, maybe an adversity generation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I could make the opposite argument. They already have had serious losses of life, measurable losses in mental health and suicide attempts, measurable losses in their math scores. And so they're a generation that has lost, but it remains unclear if they're a lost generation.
I mean, I think people in general, and maybe Americans in particular, you know, I'm not being too jingoistic to say this, I think it's really true that people tend to be pretty resilient, you know, and pretty self-reliant, and they recover from things pretty well, and they bounce back, and they keep moving upward and forward. But we've enumerated, and you just did a little bit more, so many things that are hits on this generation, mm-hmm. where they don't even have the tools to recover in many respects, you know? So, I mean, I'm generally optimistic, but I don't know if I can be that optimistic about this particular situation we're talking about. I think it's going to be a deficit no matter what. It's just a right. question of how big and how long lasting
right.
and how,
yeah, I think
and
that's
how
right.
damaging to the overall mm-hmm. economy. So we're getting toward the end of the show here, but let's talk about that. What do you think are maybe some of the likely impacts on the national economy in the future? I mean, you know, will employers have to adapt to employees with poor skills and poor work mm-hmm. ethic? And what kind of things could happen in our already struggling national economy
sure,
in the yeah. future with this kind of thing as these people enter the workforce or don't, as the case may be?
Sure. I mean, I think we'll probably have some interesting thoughts on this. It's probably important that on this point in particular, we admit that we're speculating a bit again.
Sure.
But I do think, you know, you could make an argument that there's going to be more need for social programs, more need for things like GED programs. We've seen some interesting trends where employers are taking on the responsibility of educating their workforce. Yeah, I'm not entirely a big fan of everything Google does, but they've started a school for coding, basically, and they've kind of taken educating their future workers into their own hands. I guess they think they can do it better and probably can. It is a much shorter school program, and it's cheaper than anything like a four-year university or something. So, you know, I'd be curious to see if we see things like that where employers begin to take it on themselves, especially large, you know, corporate employers that have the resources to do things like this, where they see the need to take it on themselves, that they're going to have to do more training and more educating in a way that, you know, Google has been really innovative. But you wouldn't be out of left field to say there could be things like higher national debt, more social programs, more, mm-hmm. even maybe more crime, yeah. higher, you know, or more family breakdowns. All those kind of things are in the conversation.
Well, we are right at the end of the show here, Casey, but let's kind of wrap it up. And I think we started at some point saying, we don't know if we're going to make this sound more dire than it really is, but is this situation maybe reversible? And is it as dire as we're making it sound? I mean, did the people who released that survey have any kind of opinion on that?
Sure, yeah. So quickly, you know, the survey spokesman said that this school year is, they called it an inflection point, has big implications. I think we're really at a turning point. Intervention now, there is what they say is imperative to save this generation. So I think there is hope, but we can't just keep doing what we've been doing. If we intervene, if we take steps now, if we go the extra mile to do things for this generation to get them back on track, I think there is hope to recover a lot of the losses, but whether we actually do that, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and it's going to be an exaggeration of the term, it takes a village. I think it's going to be it takes mm-hmm. a country and all the people participating in it from yeah. teachers and parents and employers and government. And that's the kind of thing it takes a humongous amount of thinking and planning and strategizing and programs to deal with. And you know, as I said at the beginning, nobody seems to be talking about this that much. So I hope that many people will begin to talk about it more in the way that you and I have just been doing. And so anyway, that's kind of the beginning of my way of saying thank you for being on with us,
sure thing.
Casey. It's been interesting. And I want to thank all of you out there for listening and putting up with us non-experts talking about stuff that you think about as well. And hopefully these are thought-provoking kind of speculations we've been making. And I also hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.